Autosport.com. All the news first.
Hello, race fans, and welcome to the Autosport Formula One Season Review podcast. With new tyres from Pirelli, movable rear wings and electronic boost buttons, we've seen more passing moves this season than during a Barcelona training match. Joining me, Henry Hope Frost, on the pod today are Autosport's Editor-in-Chief, Andrew Vandenberg.
Hello, Henry.
Autosport Magazine Editor, Charles Bradley.
Hello there.
Group F1 Editor, Jonathan Noble.
Hello.
And F1 Editor, Ed Straw.
Hi.
And not forgetting, of course, our special guest, Team Caterham F1 Work Experience bod, Karun Chandhok.
I love the intro.
We'll also be hearing from world champion Sebastian Vettel, F1's top Brit Jenson Button, and the man Autosport readers voted Rookie of the Year, Paul Di Resta. So, what better place to start than with Red Bull? It might be a fizzy drinks brand, but they certainly know how to build an F1 car. And in Sebastian Vettel, they've got a young driver who's rewriting the record books. The obvious question, guys, has to be, just how good is he? Ed, perhaps you could start us off.
Well, there's no doubt in my mind this year he's proved he'll go down as an all-time great. Last year, youngest ever world champion, great. But this year, dominant, brilliant in qualifying, and just absolutely relentless in the way he does things. The attention to detail of Seb is absolutely ruthless. He works as hard, if not harder, as any driver, and that really is the key to Formula One. It's not just enough to be fast and jump in a car. You've got to work incredibly hard, and that's what Seb does.
I've been watching F1 since the late 70s, and I can honestly say I don't think I've seen a more complete season from a driver than the one that Vettel produced this year. I mean, when the chips were down, when he had to produce it, he was just sensational. And the way that he's done it with such good humour and such good grace, I mean, he, as Ed said, he is going to go down as one of the greats of the sport.
Yeah, Andy, that's right, isn't it? He doesn't... How many mistakes did he make this year?
One, maybe. And he didn't really even spin in Canada. It was just a little bit of an off on the wet.
Yeah, Karun, you were kind of out there with him on occasion. It's a special guy, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that stands out for me, and I was chatting with his teammate Mark Webber about it in India, I remember, and which was saying, I can't remember the last time he made a mistake in qualifying. You know, I think people have often, even in the last 4 years, okay, you can say he drove into Jensen at Spa last year and he's had a few things, but when the pressure's on in Q3 and he needs to deliver that lap, and we saw it particularly towards the end of the season where McLaren were getting strong and you know, you look in Korea where Lewis is getting close and Abu Dhabi, he still came out under pressure, delivered the lap, no mistake. And I thought that's hugely impressive. Mm.
Charles?
It's worth noting the mistakes he did make were in free practice. You know, Turkey, been in the car, Canada as well, and it just doesn't matter.
Yeah, Johnny, isn't every single great in Formula One allowed a sort of certain number of big boo-boos every so often?
Well, exactly. It's making the mistakes when they don't matter. You know, the mistake in Turkey, crashing then, irrelevant, went on, won the race, all perfect. I know Ed touched on the attention to detail. I think there are two moments that stand out. One in the winter, every F1 driver was invited to Pirelli to go and meet them, meet the engineers, understand the tyres. The only man who could be bothered to go down there in December to go and have a look, Sebastian Vettel. I mean, fine, it's not worth lap time, but it's part of the attention to detail. And when he went out in Abu Dhabi, rather than storming off in a huff to his hotel, sat on the pit wall, understood how strategy unfolds, understand how the team work on the pit wall. And this is all stuff puts him in fantastic stead.
Yeah, and who is the only guy who routinely got off the line quickly and led the first lap properly by a long way on cold tyres?
Absolutely, and that's the foundation of all those wins this season. Mm. Getting clear in the first two laps, breaking the DRS, 1 second margin, and then you're gone.
Yeah, Ed.
And just in terms of his claim to be an all-time great, just a few numbers, stats can be used to prove anything. But if you compare him to Ayrton Senna, rightly or wrongly, tends to be default choice as the gold standard for drivers. Mm. In their first 81 starts, Seb's got 21 wins in that number of starts against 16 for Senna, 30 poles compared to 32 poles for Senna. That's a measure of just how strong he's been in his still very young Grand Prix career.
Yeah, Johnny, you caught up with Sebastian Vettel at the recent Autosport Awards. Let's just listen to what he had to say.
You know, there's no secret to what we have achieved this year. I think it's just, we have learned from the mistakes that we have done. I have learned from mistakes I've done because I did a lot of things that, you know, I would do different today. But, you know, I don't regret them because I think you have to go through that in a way to learn how to do it the right way, maybe. You know, if you would never do something wrong in your life, how could you judge that what you did or what you're planning to do is right or wrong? So, yeah, I think it will be a season that we always look back to and, yeah, be very proud of to have been part of it. It has been, you know, very few mistakes only this year, nearly faultless. So from all of us, so it's never easy, but you know, we will have to push very hard. I think, you know, the other people will catch up, and it will be very tight, as it has been, you know, sometimes this year. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it. You know, that's what it's all about. It would be, you know, fantastic to go around in a Formula One car against a stopwatch every single time, but really it's the competition that you're looking for, the tension, the nervousness when you're standing on the grid and when you're about to race. You know, I'm not putting myself under pressure saying that, you know, I'm young and there should be, there has to be, there will be a lot to come. I enjoy what I do and I love what I do, so. And, you know, I think you should always look forward in life and, you know, people, sometimes I get the question, has this been, you know, the best day of your life? Maybe it has, but really I'm always looking forward to have the best day of my life still to come. And I think even, you know, the day when I want to, have to, will retire, still I think, you know, you would still want to look, wake up in the morning and thinking that your nicest or your best day still is yet to come. So otherwise, you know, it would be quite sad to wake up and look back and say, oh, 10 years ago, that was the high. You know, what is it now then, you know? So as I said, I'm not thinking about that too much. Yeah, I think, you know, numbers is one thing, but I think what matters more is the style and, you know, I think, you know, people remember Nigel Mansell, for instance, not because he achieved 14 pole positions in 1 year. It's a great number and a great record, but people remember him because, you know, they felt close to him and he was a character, you know, so they remember who he was rather than what he did in a way. Of course, he was a world champion, people remember that, but you know where I tried to get. And I think it's the same when, you know, we had, you know, the Senna movie honored tonight, and it's the same when people talk about Senna, you know. Yes, of course, we remember him as a world champion, as a Grand Prix winner, but we remember him for much more than that. So
winning the world championship,
that's why I think it's difficult to, you know, statistics is one thing, but there's much more.
But for all Vettel's skills, without a car as good as the RB7, there's no way he'd have been able to seal the title in such emphatic fashion, which I suppose begs the question, how much of it is down to him and how much of it's down to the car?
I think that's a little bit of a meaningless question in a way. You can't separate the two. You don't win the championship without a great car. That's a simple fact. But the ability to get the best out of a car like that, extract the absolute maximum in a sport where tiny fractions of percentage of achievement make the difference, is really what it's all about. You need both.
Yeah, Karun, you can be as quick as you like, but you've got to have the equipment under you, haven't you?
Well, Ed touched upon Ed and Senna. I mean, I think the Red Bull that Sebastian had this year was far less dominant than the car Senna had in 88 when he won his first world championship, or the 92 Williams that Mansell had. You know, I mean, all these drivers who won all those world championships and all the all-time greats all drove a car. I mean, I'm not going into the Schumacher era, but I'm saying that, you know, the cars that they started off their sort of legendary status on were far more dominant than I think Sebastian's had this year.
Mm.
It was also, if you look at the pole average, the advantage that Seb had when he was on pole, it was on average by 0.325 seconds. That's quite a lot in F1 terms, but we're not talking half a second and a half that we've seen in the past from dominant cars.
Yeah, as Karun says, you look back at the figures from 92, I mean, 3 seconds would cover the top 10, maybe even more than that. You know, this is a completely different era of competitiveness in F1.
I'm sure Ferrari and McLaren would dearly love to know the answer to this, but what was it specifically that made the Red Bull so good?
I mean, we've seen since 2009 that really once the aero regs changed to the wide front wing and the narrow rear and all the other changes that came with it, that the Red Bull has been the most aerodynamically efficient and highest downforce producing car. I think they were a bit unlucky in 2009 that the double diffuser regulations caught them off guard. And, you know, but by the middle of the season, they were far and away the quickest car. I think operationally, they weren't maybe as slick as Brawn that year. And they didn't really, you know, the drivers made a few mistakes. Last year, again, there were a few, you know, operational issues. The drivers obviously hit each other in Turkey. Sebastian made a few mistakes. But this year, I think they've, A, got massively on top of reliability in the last 2 years. B, I think operationally, the strategies are now very good. I think the drivers are now, you know, they're in a zone. Sebastian, particularly this year, has been outstanding. I think the car, you know, they've got a very stable team of 4 or 5 top aerodynamicists, which Adrian's got around him. And year on year, they're just getting better and better and better.
Yeah, Johnny, I can think of Sebastian's puncture in Abu Dhabi, but I'm struggling to think of any other car failures for Red Bull.
Zero car failures. I think that's Mark Webber crashed in Italy, obviously went off, and much to the delights of the Tifosi.
Not a car failure, though.
And the gearbox issue for Seb in Brazil, but that didn't stop him finishing. So an unbelievable season of reliability.
The other thing about Adrian Newey's brilliance, everyone talks about his aerodynamic brilliance, but he's also a guy who really sees what matters in Formula One. When he first came into Formula One 3 decades or more ago, he knew aero was going to be vital, but he also sees the importance of tools. When he was with March as technical director 25-odd years ago, he realised that CFD was important, launched a CFD programme, and he's realised that this team, to be successful in a no-testing era, needs to be able to produce parts that go on the car and work. You can't test your way around problems.
No.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people often talk about the legend of Colin Chapman and all the rest of it back in the day. But I think Adrian's legacy, if we look back, say, in 30 years' time from today, is the fact that he's won world championships with, you know, with Williams, with McLaren, and with Red Bull. You know, he's gone out there and produced a championship-winning car in 3 different organizations with, you know, 3 different sets of people, 3 different sets of drivers. I think that's hugely, hugely important. You know, you look at Valentino Rossi. His legend went massively up when he went from Honda to Yamaha, changed teams and still had success. I think it's the same thing.
Big bike fever from the new Karun there. Excellent. We can't get sidetracked by bikes, can we? Unfortunately. Johnny, there were times when McLaren drivers Jenson Button and Lewis Hamilton could match the pace of the Red Bulls, but they only succeeded in beating them once in qualifying and what, 6 times in the races. Why was that?
Well, part of the car wasn't as quick as a Red Bull on a Saturday. You have to understand the foundations of Vettel's wins this year were those pole positions. Red Bull start of the season, DRS optimised for that one out lap on Saturday. Seb was sensational in Q3. Every time you think, they've got him, bang, pole position at the end. And once you're in the lead, Seb pulled out that 1-2 seconds in the first 2 laps, and from then on could control the pace. The guys behind were pushing, but you push, your tyres go off quicker, then you've got no chance of overhauling the guy in front who can react to your strategy. So it's all about Saturday, which is kind of ironic in a season when we had more overtaking, lots of racing. Actually, being on pole position this year was more vital than it's been in the past.
Yeah, 15 times out of 19.
Phenomenal record.
Pretty good.
Phenomenal.
Yeah. Charles, despite finishing a long way behind Vettel in the points, Jenson had a great season. Is he the kind of de facto number one at McLaren now, do you think?
I think you have to say he is. I mean, if you compare him to what Lewis did this year, he was obviously had the measure. I think if you look at his 3 wins, they were all scored in really great style. And it was interesting to hear him at the Autosport Awards at the weekend saying he thinks he's going to have more input into the 2012 car than he did into the 2011 car. So I think you're going to see more from him in the future too.
Well, I think, you know, I am a personal believer that ultimately on one lap, all things being equal, on the same day, same car, in the same zone. When I say same zone, I mean when Lewis and Jenson are at their peak, I still think Lewis may be slightly quicker. But I think what's been impressive this year is how many times Jenson has often said publicly that he's sacrificed the Saturday result to get the result on the Sunday. Mm. And you've often seen that, you know, even though he's not qualified quite up there, he's decided to play to his strengths, which is managing the tyres and working on race pace and delivering the result on a Sunday.
It's interesting. I did an interview with Martin Whitmarsh about Jenson Button, and he said, like almost no other driver, he sees the race unfolding. He gets out of the car and he has a better grasp of what's happened in the race than almost any driver. And that shows how he sees the big picture, whether it's trading off qualifying against the race or realising that if you're a little bit slow at the start of a stint, it's going to pay you back in spades at the end of it and you're going to be quicker.
Johnny, I see a guy who's been in Formula One for 11 years who's intelligent, articulate, motivated, grateful, enthusiastic. He's the proper deal.
He's got everything around him. I mean, Lewis talked about his happy bubble that Jenson's got around him that he wants to try and mirror. You know, Jenson knows exactly what's there, and there's detail there in his career. I mean, a fascinating anecdote I found out from Jenson this year. If you look at photos of Jenson on the grid this season before the start, he's not wearing racing boots, he's wearing trainers on the grid, which I thought was a bit weird when I first noticed it in Korea. So over dinner with Jenson in Brazil this year, I said, what's that about? Jenson, because he likes to modulate the brake so much, has very, very thin soles on his racing boots. And if he walks out the car and walks around the grid with his racing boots on, they'll crack, they'll stretch, they won't be as good in the car. So he thought, what I need to do is wear trainers, look after my racing boots. You know, this is the level of detail that these guys are operating at. And it just shows Jenson as well is thinking about every single facet of his operation.
Actually, I'm surprised that hasn't been picked up, actually.
Well, it has today.
On the TV, you know, if someone's actually there kind of watching it and...
I think something that spoke volumes about Jensen's maturity this year was when he had two horrendous results, Silverstone and Nürburgring, where he had obviously the wheel came off at Silverstone, a hydraulics failure in Germany, and he just bounced back. You know, he had that such a level-headed approach, and we didn't see that from Lewis this year, did we? In that mid-season, when he got into a trough, he got into a real all sorts of problems, didn't he? Was totally off form, ended up racing and barging into Felipe Massa. And with Jensen, you see, if he does have a problem, he can just totally bounce back from it.
Karun, are you expecting to see a kind of revitalised Hamilton, the guy who kind of was mega in 07 and 08?
I think we already have. I mean, you look at Korea, I think from then on he's been strong. Korea, he, you know, he's right in there in the hunt for pole, and you know, he was a little bit unlucky that he got passed on lap one. I think Sebastian lined him up quite well, and after that they didn't have the pace. But again, after that you look in India, you look at you know, the rest of the season, Abu Dhabi. Obviously he won the race. You know, I think he's been very competitive. So I think he has bounced back, and it depends a lot on the winter, but. It's tough, you know, when you've got a teammate like Jensen who's in, like Johnny said, in a happy place, and he's, and obviously Lewis hasn't been. You know, I think it's the first time in his career that he's been beaten by a teammate. So it's, you know, I'm sure it's been tough, but I think he did bounce back. I think a lot of people who wrote him off midway through the year need to look at the last sort of part of the season.
Well, Jensen's efforts were rewarded by winning British Competition Driver of the Year at the recent Autosport Awards. Let's hear now from the 2009 World Champion about his thoughts on that.
It's been a very good year. You know, I feel that I've really grown with this team, and you know, McLaren is always a team that I've wanted to be with since I was a little kid. So to really fit in with this team and to grow with this team really does mean a lot to me. We've spent 2 years together now. It's flown by. It's quite scary. It's been two seasons already. But I feel that we've really improved. And I feel that with a tiny bit more improvement, we can really fight for more victories in 2012. You know, my aim was to arrive at McLaren and win races and be with a team that can always give me the chance of winning the World Championship. We haven't quite won the World Championship the last 2 years, but I've won quite a few races with this team. And I feel that our time is coming. And yeah, Red Bull's the team to beat. Done a great job, and hopefully we'll have a good chance of doing that in the future. Japan meant a lot to me because, you know, I've got a lot of connections to Japan over the last sort of 8 years, and to have won that Grand Prix on a circuit that I love, you know, it's such a high-speed circuit, a circuit that should suit a Red Bull. To win there in front of the Japanese fans after what they've been through this year was a very special victory. It's not my best year in F1. You know, winning the World Championship is always what you're here to do, so 2009 was my best year, but you grow as a driver, and every year you should always be willing to learn. And for me, I've grown as a driver. I've grown in confidence. I've grown in confidence not just in my ability in driving, but also in my ability of working with the team and putting my point forward. So, yeah, I've definitely grown. And I feel stronger now than I ever have done.
Since the last major rule change ahead of the 2009 season, every year McLaren has started slowly and improved as the season has gone on. Ed, why can't McLaren hit the ground running in March?
Well, they just seem to make very, very slight misjudgments with things. They had this octopus exhaust in pre-season testing this year. Because if you remember, after pre-season testing, they were nowhere. I remember being at the Barcelona test with Gary Anderson, our technical consultant, who used to work with Jordan and Stewart. And we were watching at turn three, long, quick right-hander, and the car looked awful. It was just, it just didn't have the same downforce levels. They put this sort of band-aid over it, this good exhaust blown diffuser that allowed them to finish second and on merit in Melbourne, but it just seems that the car concept isn't quite right. It's almost there, but interestingly, Pat Fry, who's now at Ferrari, he's the de facto technical director with a slightly convoluted job title, and talking about Nicholas Tambasis, who moved from McLaren to Ferrari, he said that he felt the difference between Tambasis at Ferrari and McLaren is that Ferrari's able to get the best out of him, whereas McLaren didn't. So you just wonder if there's something structurally there that's not quite getting the last fraction of a percent out of all the tremendous engineering talent they've got there.
Johnny, does McLaren sort of go off on slightly kind of convoluted, overcomplicated tangents over the winter, and does it trip over itself? And
I think that was the key mistake this season. They went too radical with this exhaust. I think over the winter, the teams that were quick understood that a blown diffuser or that kind of exhaust concept was going to be key to perform this season. Red Bull did the standard blown diffuser that we've come to know them as, got it right, and that was the foundations of their success from the start. McLaren tried this ultra-complicated octopus exhaust, you know, channeling gases into some chamber and then pumping them out, which was wrecked their pre-season test. pre-Melbourne, they copied the Red Bull design and they're off. But, you know, those lost 6 weeks were essentially where they lost ground to Red Bull in the title.
Are we expecting any sort of magic button next year with the outlawing of double diffusers? Who's gonna benefit from a kind of more of a level playing field?
Well, you probably have to guess Ferrari, because we saw what happened at Silverstone when the off-throttle blowing saga, when it wasn't on there, the team that came out on top there was Ferrari. So if I was going to say anyone's going to benefit from not having it next season, it's going to be Ferrari.
There's always something, isn't there? There's mass dampers, there's double diffusers, there's forward-facing exhausts. Do we have any kind of premonitions about what loopholes will be explored next year?
If there were, I'd have given them to teams and now be earning a mega salary, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we'd be earning the big bucks, wouldn't we?
Ed's got one.
My premonition is there will be something. There will be a lot of arguing. Whoever comes up with it will definitely say it's illegal. Whoever doesn't come up with it will say it's definitely illegal.
Arguing. That's the new
There will be an enormous buzzword. Amount of arguing, yeah. And the cleverest team will win, as usual.
Let's move on. Karun, just one win for Scuderia Ferrari over what you've got to say was a very disappointing season. What went wrong there?
Well, I think... I sort of look at two things. One, as Johnny rightly said, Silverstone, the one race where we didn't have the blown diffuser working in the way that it has done at the other 18. Ferrari and Alonso won a genuine race on merit. You know, he came out of the pits. I know Sebastian had a poor pit stop, but he came out of the pits 10 seconds behind Fernando and the gap went up to 17 seconds. So, you know, that was a genuine win on pace from Alonso. I remember speaking to him in the middle of the year and he was saying that for them, in the high-speed corners, they feel they are quicker, if not as quick as the Red Bulls. They just don't feel that they're as quick in the slow speed. The other thing which became very apparent, if you looked at the season, was that they just didn't use the harder tyre enough in the races. You know, you look at Abu Dhabi, for example, on the stints in the softer tyre, Alonso was just as quick as Lewis, switched to the harder one at the end, and he just couldn't do it. You know, they dropped back in pace. And the same thing happened in Brazil. You know, till the last stint, he was... okay in third place and then go to the harder tyre and Jensen just gets him. And you know, I spoke to Stefano Domenicali about it in Abu Dhabi, in fact, saying, you know, you guys are so close in terms of pace to getting that performance on the softer one. But it's just a little bit on the harder tyre, which is 3 or 4 tenths a lap. And, you know, over a stint, it's just too much, particularly in the first 5 or 6 laps. So I think those were the two things that they know, they're aware of the problem. And as Johnny said, it'll be interesting to see with the blown diffuser rules changing for next year what happens.
I think the point about the slower corner disadvantage of the Ferrari gets to the heart of the issue. The Red Bull exhaust blown diffuser was extremely effective, produced a lot of downforce, but also it was the fact that Renault could provide these off-throttle blowing engine map strategies that would allow you to produce a huge amount of rear-end grip, rear-end downforce, while the driver wasn't on the throttle. And obviously, that points to the fact that next year that advantage will be gone. But then again, it's gone for everyone. Most teams are exploiting it to a greater or lesser degree. So that's perhaps the one hope for people. All things being equal, Red Bull should still be ahead at the start of next season if they do the job properly. But this one, I don't want to call it a trump card because everyone had it, but it was an extremely strong part of that car, particularly with how the Pirelli rear tyres didn't have a great deal of grip and you needed as much rear downforce as you could get.
Yeah. Fernando Alonso's got a long-term deal with Ferrari. Do we think he's pushing the team in the right direction?
Well, I think when you look at we've eulogised about Sebastian Vettel and Jenson Button, haven't we? But I think if you look at 2011 drivers, you have to say the other part of the Holy Trinity this year is Fernando Alonso. He's been absolutely brilliant. All you've got, if you want to pause this podcast, get on YouTube and look at his start in Spain. You know, that's amazing the way he carved through from fourth to first in the first corner. Shows he's really pushing hard.
And Monza too.
Absolutely, and Monza as well. And I think at the end of the day, it's not so much him driving the team in the right direction. It comes back to Pat Fry and the new aerodynamic people.
But I do think there are times when Fernando's not pushing as hard as he can. I mean, Japanese Grand Prix is a classic example. Ferrari's season was kind of trickling towards the end. Fernando, all weekend, didn't seem on it. Suddenly, final third of the race, he senses, oh, hang on a minute, I could win this. Bang, suddenly lap times that weren't there all weekend suddenly turning up. So I think Fernando at times as well could be pushing a bit harder.
Bit of a motivation problem?
Well, probably. I think when you're fighting for a win, you're going to put it more on the line than when you're fighting for fifth and sixth. And I think Fernando's probably one of the examples of the guys at the front who won't make the extra push if he's only battling fifth or sixth.
But I think that comes because he's a double world champion. You know, he's in it for the big prize. He's not he doesn't care about maybe even a race win. He could give up. He's always thinking about the proper big prize at the end of the day.
Probably find second place really annoying.
probably. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you look back. I mean, you question how much Senna pushed back in '93. You know, when it was a wet race, he knew he was in with a chance. You look at the end of the season, he knew he was in with a chance because McLaren had a few updates on the car, and he won Suzuka and Adelaide. You know, so
with a ropey old V8 in the back.
Yeah, I mean, it's that's what I'm saying. So there is a bit of that, but I still think overall, in terms of a race driver on the Sunday for that part, you know, for the 2 hours of the weekend on Sunday, Fernando is still the best man you'd have in terms of relentless pace, lap after lap after lap across the season. If you look at consistency, you know, you'd have to say Fernando and Vettel are probably the two best on the grid.
Yeah, and when his chance came at Silverstone, he took it, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think he's great at motivating the team as well. You know, for me, he's a fantastic asset for Ferrari in all senses. You know, he's Latin. He you know, the fans love him. He speaks the language of the people back at the factory. You know, I think in many ways, and they need a strong leader. He's you know, a big personality, and I think he's good in a way that you know, Michael was back in the early part of the decade.
Andy, we could devote an entire podcast to Felipe Massa, couldn't we? First Ferrari driver since Didier Pironi in 1981, brackets megastat, to spend the whole season for Ferrari without getting on the podium. It's just unbelievable, isn't it? He hasn't won a race since 08. What's going on there?
Well, I think in a time when lots of companies are letting very loyal, long-serving members of staff go in the face of an economic crisis, Ferrari should be applauded for their loyalty. But that aside, I think it's an indication of the sort of inherent conservativeness of the decision-making process that goes behind a lot of driver selection. And I think you could point the finger at the lack of the role for the third driver, test drivers, this day and age. I think if you remember the time when the young drivers used to take those Friday runs, Felipe Massa would have lost his drive by now. Mm. If Jules Bianchi or someone else was driving that Ferrari on a Friday, showing what the potential of that car could be, then the pressure on him would have been mounted to an insurmountable levels. I mean, the fact that he was toiling around in fifth and sixth places in a car that was fighting for podiums, and even when he did string a fast lap together, it was followed by another one where he was going off the track. And it was just, we've just put together our top 50 drivers of 2011, and I won't be giving much away by saying he didn't make it. And in fact, the question is, yeah, how far down would we have had to go for him to get in it? Yeah. In the top 100? Maybe. You know, and for a driver that's in one of the top three teams on the grid, that's just unforgivable.
Yeah, and Ed, Alonso had a win and nine other podiums. So you compare the two, it's sort of chalk and cheese, isn't it?
Well, I think we've got an enormous amount of evidence to say that he's not up to being a top-line Grand Prix driver anymore. You know, he's competent, he's fine, but it's just not enough. I mean, let's say the Ferrari is, hypothetically, it's as quick as the McLaren and the Red Bull next year. If that happens, Ferrari will not win the Constructors' Championship because of Felipe Massa. It's all well and good having a number two driver to Fernando, and that's probably what you need, but he's just not producing the results. He's not backing up Alonso as he should be. And I think we're at the point now where you look at his inconsistency. There's flashes of tremendous pace there, but he struggles sometimes to put the laps together, doesn't always string the races together. You've got to start asking whether that injury in 09 has taken just that little edge off him. I'm sorry to say, it's not his fault, but I don't think he's the same driver he was in 2008 and the first part of 2009. And after 2 years into his comeback, it's hard to see that coming back.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Johnny, is that the thing? Is that incident in Hungary in 09, has that affected him? Well, is that just very easy, an excuse to just throw in?
He's definitely not had the consistency on Sundays. I mean, he outqualified Fernando, had a good run about qualifying Fernando in the second half of this season. But on Sundays, you know, the long run pace isn't there, and no end of times you'd hear Rob Smedley on the pit wall, you know, saying, come on, Felipe, lose the mistakes, stop the mistakes, be more consistent. So there are frustrations there, and I think Felipe's only kept his seat because of the circumstance of the driver market. Mm. The Robert Kubica uncertainty meant Ferrari didn't really know what they were doing for a driver for next season. Lots of drivers were available for 2013, and you weren't really going to find a top-line replacement willing to come in for 2012 with no guarantee of a race seat in 2013.
I think we can say with certainty that if Robert Kubica had done this season with Renault, he'd be in the Ferrari next year. They admire him. If they knew he was fit and ready and all had gone well, they'd have replaced Massa with him. Because also, Robert Kubica is one of the few top-line guys who you know you could probably put with Fernando Alonso and it would work.
Yeah, we'll talk about Kubica in a minute when we get on to Renault, or is it Lotus? Like an anonymous bass player in a big rock band, the final member of the Big Four, Mercedes, struggled to make an impression this year. And for the second season in a row, they built a car that was basically a flawed concept. Why was that?
Well, they ended up with this relatively short wheelbase car, which just didn't work. You know, again, the thing you need with these Pirelli tyres is as much rear grip, stability, downforce as you can possibly get, and that didn't play to it, as well as giving you a slightly higher centre of gravity. But, you know, Ross Brawn continues to talk about this team that downsized to 2009 and then built back up again. They're always saying, well, we're rebuilding, we're bringing new people in, you know, guys like Aldo Costa and Jeff Willis coming in. But it's very clear that this team has never quite, in normal circumstances, been able to produce a top championship-winning car. The 2009 Brawn was an exception. They threw everything, they threw half their flipping 2008 budget at the 2009 car, and it was well ahead of everyone at the start of the season, but then fell back. So there's a fundamental problem in that team that they need to address, and that's what Ross is trying to address by bringing these people in. But I can't see next year they're going to take a gigantic step forward. They need a few years to chip away and get on terms with the top guys.
I mean, I got to know Jeff Willis really well when we were at HRT and last season. I spent a lot of time with him, and even this year we kept in touch. I have a lot of time for Jeff, I think, and a lot of people at the Brackley factory, which is 200 meters from my house, all have a lot of time for him as well. I think, just speaking with him in Brazil when he came to Mercedes, or came as his first race with Mercedes, you know, he's very realistic. He knows that next year they need to score regular podiums. They're probably not going to be in a position to win races next year, but they know that to keep it going and to build momentum, they need to start getting regular podiums. I think that, you know, that is a realistic target for them. And I think a lot of people have questioned, and I know a lot of people have written stories questioning having effectively four technical directors or four people who have held technical director posts, you know, in Bob Bell, Aldo Costa, Jeff, and obviously Ross. So, he had a very valid explanation, which it's not fair for me to go into, but into how they're going to structure it. And, they are making moves, but as Ed says, I think only time will tell as to whether they do deliver on that promise.
I did an interview with Michael Schumacher in Brazil, and he said that it's going to be 2013 before you start to really see tangible on-track benefits from this recruitment drive, and therefore you've got to start looking towards 2014 even, when we should have the new chassis and engine regulations. Is that going to be the reset where this Mercedes project will show whether it's going to succeed as a championship-winning force or just be quite good?
Mm. And just before the 2013 season, Michael Schumacher will be 44. Is he still going to be around?
I think he wants to be, as long as he doesn't think he's wasting his time with Merck. He wants to be there.
Mm. Johnny, any signs that we're going to see win number 92 from Michael anytime soon?
Well, I think that all depends on the car. If the car's capable of winning, you know, the question is Michael good enough to be that man up there? And I think the evidence of this season is yes, he is. In the second half of the year, he was reignited. They had an engineering reshuffle. Jock Clear came back, Pete Bonington, and the three of them were ultra-competitive guys, worked really hard to make steps forward up there with Nico. And I was at the Mercedes engine factory in Brixworth yesterday, just discussing various aspects of the season. There's a great anecdote from the Indian Grand Prix where Michael had qualified 11th and obviously knew he needed to make progress at the start. Now, most normal drivers would have used all their Kerrs off the line to try and dive their way through into turn one. But Michael didn't do that. He waited. He kept all his Kerrs up, used it all on the long back straight. So at the end of it, he was going 18 clicks quicker than every other car, overtook four people and off. You know, these are the little details that are the kind that make a difference. I show Michael still got the intelligence and the attitude to go out there and fight for it.
The one concern for Michael is still that qualifying pace. And he admits he still hasn't mastered the art of getting the tyres at exactly the right performance window in terms of temperature for that one fastest lap. And he'd love to go back to the days where he could take a load of sets of tyres and drive around Fiorano and learn. And I'm sure he'd get on top of it immediately. That's the only weakness. His race pace is extremely good and was very often better than that of Nico Rosberg, and I think probably in the right circumstance with the right car he can win races, but that I would like to see a little bit of an improvement in qualifying. It's not as important as it once was, but if you're going to start a question of rows behind your teammate, that is a little bit of a disadvantage to be carrying into races.
Mm. Charles, Nico's committed to Mercedes. There was talks of him going to Ferrari. Do you think he's done a good enough job in comparison with the old man of Formula One?
Yeah, I think so. I think he's definitely there and there or thereabouts. I think he just needs the car to be able to show that he can be an absolute out and out top line driver. He's never really had the chance to do that other than a few flashes with Williams. Obviously, that Singapore race sticks in the memory when he hit the pit lane exit. He's led quite a few laps in his Grand Prix career now, but you don't ever feel he's had the car to deliver. a race win.
Autosport.com. All the news first.
Outside the top three teams, Renault was the only outfit to score a podium finish, yet it ended the year struggling to even get in the points. Johnny, what on earth went wrong with Renault?
Two aspects went wrong at Renault. One, the Robert Kubica incident pre-season kind of tore apart their season before it started. They'd come off the Valencia test. Car was working brilliantly. Robert topped the times. A week later, the rally crash. He's out and the team suddenly lost its leader. So there's all the pre-season unsettlement with that. Nick Heidfeld didn't really step up to the job as much as they'd hoped. And the exhaust concept, you know, very good at the start, as it showed at the first two races with the podiums, but impossible to develop. The team lost weeks in the wind tunnel, lost even more time upgrading the wind tunnel from 50 to 60%. Never really got to grips with making the steps forward, you know, as Red Bull made big progress with a standard blown diffuser. So that's the story of their season.
But podiums in Australia and Malaysia for Petrov and Heidfeld, they must have thought, hey, we're on to a winner here.
Well, totally, but F1's a development race. You know, there's always that old adage that you stand still in Formula 1, you go backwards, and that's Renault's season. They pretty much ended the season where they started it, and what was good enough for third place in Melbourne wasn't hardly good enough for points towards the end of the year.
James Allison, the technical director at Renault, who ultimately was responsible for making the decision, it was a fairly sound choice at the time to go with those exhausts, but it just happened that the concept that they put on the car that was developed in CFD was actually pretty close to maxing out the potential of the concept. Normally they put something like that on a car, I think, well, it's outperforming our normal diffuser, so we can expect to make gains. And they very rapidly found that not only was there a limit to how much more they could develop it, but there was also this huge weakness in the 60 kilometre an hour to 100 kilometre an hour range, when just on the power coming out of corners, they just had no rear downforce. And that combined with the fact that the rear tyres were so low grip in terms of the balance, just completely killed them, which is why they were so terrible at Singapore.
Charles, Nick Heidfeld lost his gig halfway through the year and was replaced by your old mate Bruno Senna. Did Senna do enough to justify a place on the grid, you know, going forward?
I think you saw two real flashes of why Bruno does deserve a place on the grid. I think you saw it at Spa in qualifying and Brazil in qualifying as well. What he didn't deliver really was in the races, and I think that's the consistency side of his game is the part he needs to work on. Having said that, it took them so long to sling Heidfeld in the first place. Why didn't they give him the chance earlier? We might have had the chance to see that sooner.
I think we touched upon the point of how difficult it is for reserve and test drivers to get mileage nowadays. I mean, you know, I think Bruno had a few days in the older 2009 car, you know, before he came into these races at Spa. But even so, it's not the same. You know, it's really, really difficult to just get in it and get on with things. And I think, you know, to answer the question, yeah, he does deserve a place. And, you know, we'll see how things unfold. But I think he does deserve a place on the grid.
I think fundamentally what the part season Bruno did this year showed was that the underlying pace he's got, although he couldn't always harness it and couldn't always string it together in the races, he is a quicker racing driver than Vitaly Petrov is. And I think ultimately that's all he could do in that part season was show, well, look, Vitaly's an okay Grand Prix driver, but I'm a little bit better.
Yeah, I'd second that. I think I'd rather see Raikkonen and Senna together than Raikkonen and Petrov next year.
Did Bruno finish runner-up to Glock, didn't he, in GP2? I got the right year?
No, it was Pantano.
That's right. And Petrov was only about fourth or fifth in the championship.
Yeah, he won at Valencia, didn't he, that year? Yeah, he was there or thereabouts, but he wasn't consistent in the way that Bruno and certainly Giorgio was.
It's tricky for Bruno, isn't it? If he does well, it's because he's a Senna. If he doesn't, it's that kind of, oh, you know, you're not...
Yeah, but I mean, I know Bruno really well. I mean, he's probably my best mate in the paddock, and I think he's now spent enough years with a Senna name. He's quite comfortable with it. I think, you know, he's quite ready to acknowledge the fact that he would not be in the position that he is without the Senna name in many ways. You know, it has helped him as much as if not more than it's put pressure on him. I think he's quite proud of you know, having the Senna name with it and you know, is prepared to deal with the baggage perhaps that comes with it.
I think the other point that Bruno's made about the occasional struggles he had in the races this year was that effectively once he finished second in GP2, he went off to do the Orica sports car program to learn how to develop a car, and then he was saddled with an HRT that wasn't exactly the machine of choice in Formula One, and Caroon knows all about that. But he basically found that when he came back, he hadn't really raced since the end of 2008, you know, proper wheel-to-wheel, cut-and-thrust sprint racing. He can't use that as an excuse forever, and if he gets a full season next year, he's got to get on top of it. But you can at least take a small amount of that and put that into the context of what he did and say, yeah, it's understandable.
And you've got to look at the motivating factors as well. I think two incidents stand out this season. You know, Senna came into Renault in Belgium. A lot of questions about why they got rid of Nick Heidfeld. And Eric Boullier said, you know, we need someone to motivate this team and lift them up. You know, and in the garage after qualifying, you know, whole team cheering for the first time since the Malaysian Grand Prix was very important for them. And then after Abu Dhabi, it wasn't Bruno Senna who launched off on one and into his local television station criticising the team.
No.
It was Petrov. You know, big, big error from Vitaly there to you know, not get the team behind him.
Do you think Petrov's talked himself out of that deal?
Could well have done. I think if you criticise a team the way that Vitaly did after Abu Dhabi, you know, it's not going to put you in good stead for going forwards at all.
No, that's right.
I think particularly when you're in Vitaly's position, I don't want to be too negative about him. You know, he's a capable driver, but there's a lot of little mistakes he makes in races. If you were going out every race and absolutely nailing it and saying, well, why did we do this strategy? Why did you do that? One thing, that's one thing. But if you've, you know, squandered a few seconds here or there, little mistakes, little errors in pit stops, and suddenly you think, well, I finished 12th in that race and I'm 4 seconds off ninth and I've lost six or seven myself. You've got to start looking at yourself, and teams just don't take it that kind of thing from a driver criticising them who hasn't done the maximum themselves.
Yeah. Right, Force India started the year pretty slowly but came on strong in the second half of the season. Karun, what's the secret behind that, do you think?
I think it shows tremendous depth in the aero department. You know, if you look at the way the season went on, in the last six or seven races, I think they were always in Q3. Brazil particularly was a tremendous performance from them. I think, you know, they lost obviously a lot of people, or they lost some people in the last year or so, but it shows that the core team to develop that car was still there. I mean, they really, you know, given the if you look at the budget and what they spend versus the, you know, what they've achieved on track, I think it's been a great season for them.
Yeah, I'll be our second. I think after Red Bull, they're probably the team of the season. I think they're really smart operators, and they had that big update mid-season. But what they didn't do was just throw bits at the car. You know, I remember back when Toyota had the biggest budget in history, they were developing so many bits they couldn't possibly have even known whether the bit they were replacing was working.
Yeah.
Whereas Force India gone about it in a very clever way, maximising the percentages of what they've got in that car, and they delivered the results. I mean, Sutil's drive in Brazil, fantastic.
Yeah.
And there's no reason why they shouldn't be carrying that on forward to next year.
It's a very valid point about the sound decision-making process. The foundations for this year were laid last year when they realised in the second half of the year they were upgrading the car, but they'd pretty much maxed out the concept. They weren't great on peak downforce, very good on aero efficiency. It was a handy car, but to kick on and become consistently quick, they needed to take a few steps back. They started developing wind tunnel testing, a new aero package. I think it was October, and it started off not producing the same downforce figures as their current car, but they kept working at it. They started the season with a car that was pretty basic. It wasn't a huge step forward, but in Spain they started to put things on the car. They had an exhaust blown diffuser that was just a long way ahead of anything they had before, and then that concept, they put it on the car, and they were just away. I mean, they Andrew Green, the technical director there, who took over as technical director after all the recent departures they've had, he said that they knew they were committing to being in a black hole at the start of the season, and they were very slow at the start of the year. And can you imagine if they'd made that decision to go with that package, started the season slowly, and then that package hadn't worked? They'd have been down not far ahead of Williams. So it was a very bold and intelligent decision they made that show you that this is a team that's actually got its act together pretty well.
Yeah. Johnny, Paul de Resta made his Formula One debut in 2011. This is a guy who beat Sebastian Vettel in the same equipment in Formula 3. Do you reckon, how do you rate his efforts?
Yeah, brilliant season. You started off, I'm always a great believer that the your kind of image in F1 is defined by your first four or five races, that you kind of get labelled by it. And he came in, delivered points, you know, great, great start. I'd have been interested to know what Adrian Sutil would have done if he'd been kind of fighting for his career, you know, every single race, because, you know, he was sensational at the end of the season, you know, delivered great results against Paul towards the end. But this was a man, you know, people always seem to deliver more when there's no contract coming up. So we never really, I would have loved to have known if Sutil had a contract till mid-season, how it would have gone earlier on in the year.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to admit that at the start of the season, I think even when we sat down at the our preview at the Kushbu, you know, I was slightly sceptical about, you know, Force India taking Paul on. But you know, I'm the first to admit that I think I was, you know, I was wrong. I think he's done an outstanding job this year, and he's totally deserves Rookie of the Year.
The other thing about Paul is, you know, we know he's a quick racing driver. We know he's had success in the past. But the thing about Paul is he's got that intelligence and that understanding. He plays the long game. He came into the season knowing exactly what he needed to do against Adrian. He did exactly what he needed to do to ensure he gets further seasons. He's got a touch of the Alonso's about him. He's quite a clever guy who really knows what he needs to achieve and really focuses on doing that and doesn't just think, oh, I'll get in the car and drive quickly. And he applies that to everything, which I think is why he's a guy who's potentially got a future as a Grand Prix winner, because he's got that intelligence to go with the speed and the ability just to drive around quickly.
Yeah, well, our readers thought that DiResta was Rookie of the Year in Formula 1 2011. Let's hear the young Scots' views on that.
It's quite satisfying. Obviously, it's been a good year, one that I've enjoyed probably the most of my career, albeit not probably the most successful in terms of results, but a massive challenge, and to undertake that and come out where we were, I suppose, to be in good spirits and certainly be very proud to be part of Force India and what they've achieved this year. I think you always go away from any class and go away in the winter, and for some reason, I don't know why, but you come back as a stronger person. And I believe that, and it's not something to do with, you know, your emotions. It's not something that drives you. It just happens. I hope it does. Get a bit more speed, because, you know, if you get more speed, hopefully you'll be more successful with it. If you see the difference where we started this year to what we moved on to, it's been incredible. And, you know, those foundation blocks that we built earlier in the year were going to compromise us a bit, but we came out a much stronger package towards the end of the year than we ever imagined we would be. And if we can keep that momentum continuing into next year, and I'll be, you know, hopefully part of that to undertake the challenge, you know, to our nearest competitors this year, which were Renault.
Sauber had a typically solid season, Ed. Is the team just too conservative to make the step up to the next level?
Well, ultimately, I think it's a little bit of an unfair question on them. It sounds like a criticism to say that the team's living within its means. They don't have a huge staff. They're a medium Grand Prix team. They're, I don't know, the sixth or seventh biggest team, maybe the seventh team. They finished seventh. They're about where they should be. You know, you don't get anything spectacular from them. But I think they've got a sensible approach that doesn't just say, well, we're going to throw money we haven't got and gamble on being successful. The other thing about the conservative image is they've got a pretty exciting driver lineup there. Peter Sauber loves throwing rookies into the mix, and Sergio Perez was really impressive this season, really showed his pace, even though he didn't come out with as many points as he could have done. And obviously we know how good Kamui Kobayashi can be in a racing situation as well. So I think, you know, they're a good, solid, middle-grid Grand Prix team. They're not going to mortgage their future. At the same time, they're not going to do anything amazing and bring out a car that makes a draw drop and wins them 15 Grand Prix in a year.
Do you think they've recovered from that kind of sort of hitting the big-time championship-chasing BMW tie-up? Because they've kind of gone back to the sort of, you know, the level they were at before that.
They've cut a lot of staff, and they restructured under James Key, their new technical director, who came in from Force India last season. You know, whole working groups that were separate entities within the technical side have been broken up and reformed as much smaller groups. It's a much smaller team now. They've just bought Willem Tote in as head of aero. He was head of aero in the BMW Sauber days. He was at RML most recently. So, that, you know, they're still picking off the right people. And having a strong aero head is important, because obviously James Key, as a technical director, comes from a race engineering background. You often get these, you get race engineering technical directors and you get aero technical directors, it seems to me, at the moment. And so now they've got kind of heads for both sides of that I think could serve them well.
Mm. I mean, I think you look at Sauber's best season was, I believe, 2001, if you forget the BMW era. But, you know, when they were still a small team, produced a car that finished fourth in the world championship. But I think, as we've touched upon, the, you know, F1's changed. I think F1's a lot more competitive today. There's a lot more teams in that midfield, and also, you know, times have changed where the gap to the top three or four is just, they've just moved that a little bit further away. So it's hard for a, you know, as Johnny said, the attention's more on the detail. So there's, you know, the big concepts such as the double diffuser don't really come along that often for a midfield team like Sauber to really leap into the top four.
Charles, Kamui Kobayashi, you've followed him through GP2 and Euro Series F3. How good is he?
Well, it's an interesting point, really. If you look back at those old days, he was never as good as some of his teammates or some of the guys in the championships. When you look at him in Formula One, again, you probably say he's not top draw, but he has these fantastic days in the sun where if you go wheel to wheel with him, he can quite easily come out on top. You know, he's got this fantastic fighting spirit about him. You know, he's a lovely bloke. He makes the world a better place being around the paddock. But would you ever say he's ever going to be a top-line Formula 1 driver? Well, probably not, but I think it'd be a poorer place without him.
is he the most competent Japanese Grand Prix driver we've ever had?
I think he's the most successful, the best Japanese driver we've had in F1. And if you look at him, I think in terms of raw, all-out pace, he lacks a little bit. And we saw that in qualifying comparison against Sergio Perez. His real strength is in races. He just gets on with it. He doesn't let his head drop. He's consistently quick. He can pass. You know, he's a guy you can throw to the back of the grid and you know there's a chance he'll make a great start and really, really get in amongst the points, because he just has that mindset of, I'm here to do a job. I'm not going to overcomplicate it. I'm just going to get on with it. And that will always be a valuable commodity. You'll always get a job done. I don't think he's a superstar. I don't think he'd sign him if you're a Red Bull. But he's got a good future as a solid, consistent point-scoring midfield driver. Mm.
But I tell you what, I really rate Perez. I think if Kubica doesn't come back in 2013 with Ferrari, I'd love to see him in that car against Alonso, because he's actually could be the real deal.
Yeah. Guys, did we ever see the best from Toro Rosso this season? Silence in the studio.
I think that says it all, really. I mean, they've got two quite good drivers. And I think, I mean, that is sort of damning with faint praise, but that's what... they're both sort of that same level. But you don't know, you know, back in the days when Toro Rosso had Sebastian Vettel and they could outperform the parent team, there's still some very good people there. And they did a very clever concept with that sort of double floor under the side pods. So that was a good car. If they'd have had a Vettel there, would the results have been better? I mean, I'm prepared to argue, I think they would have been substantially better. That's not to say Buemi or Alguersuari are bad drivers, but I just don't think either of them are the next Sebastian Vettel.
No.
An interesting chat with Giorgio Ascanelli, their technical director there, who's Italian, a great character, got a huge amount of respect for him.
And worked with Senna at McLaren.
Worked with some great drivers, obviously worked with Vettel when he was there. But he said of the drivers, he harked back to a day when Jean Todt was talking about bringing Schumacher into Ferrari. And he said, well, I think Schumacher, yeah, you definitely sign him, but Ferrari isn't ready for Schumacher. He's too good as a driver. And the point he was kind of making is that, you know, we've got two good drivers. I guess we could have better ones, but we've got the drivers we deserve. They're a good midfield team. They've got two good, competent midfield drivers who'll score you a decent number of points. Sebastian Buemi's a good qualifier. Alguersuari sometimes emerges as a better racer. They're fine. I think there's a bit more in that car, but they're about par.
There's not much, is there, between Buemi and Alguersuari? Karun, if you were Franz Tost, who would you keep if you couldn't keep them both?
I mean, it's tricky. You know, they're both fairly evenly matched, as you said. You got to look at it at various other angles. You know, maybe Alguersuari's got slightly more commercial support that could be tied into him. You know, it's a question of do they want to change the lineup? Do they want to experiment with somebody new? Maybe Dan Ricciardo or Jean-Éric Vergne has been talked about. And I think ultimately you have to think about what is the purpose of the team. I don't know the answer to that. You know, they need to think about that. Is it a question of training drivers and putting them in the big team like they did with Vettel? Do they feel that they need to train up a replacement for Mark in the near future? You know, that's really the big question, is what is their ultimate purpose, you know, or do they want to be a completely independent team, not connected to the big one? It's a big question.
I would have thought by now we'd have had Buemi or Alguersuari knocking on that Mark Webber door by now, wouldn't we? As when you consider Toro Rosso to be the finishing school.
I always think that you judge drivers by their kind of standout moments, that, you know, any big, high-quality driver always has standout moments, standout races. And you look over Buemi and Alguersuari's career, and can you remember, you think of one other than two wheels falling off in China?
Right, that's the midfield taken care of. Coming up, or should that be going down, in part three, the tail enders and our personal highlights of the season.
Autosport.com. All the news first.
Right, deep breath. Williams, in the final part of our countdown, how did this happen, Karun?
I think Williams is one of those teams who's sort of everybody's favourite team in many ways, just because of Frank and the history of it all. And, it is sad to see where they finish this year. They had a very innovative concept, I think, with the gearbox this year. I remember standing at the end of the pit lane in Valencia, the pre-season test, and just being amazed when Rubens came to do a practice start at how small the gearbox was. And just, you know, you could see the angle of the drive shafts just to see, they'd obviously chased that concept. And, you know, the gearbox is one of the key parts of the car that needs to be defined quite early in the design phase. I think they just it didn't quite click straight from the beginning of the season. And then in the development race again, they just weren't quite able to match up to the midfield teams, and they got sort of dropped behind.
I think the one thing you have to say in Williams' defence, and I don't want to say they've had anything other than a very bad season, obviously the Cosworth engine, they couldn't get the same engine mapping that some of the other teams were able to do, so they weren't able to get as powerful an exhaust-blown diffuser. That said, you can't blame that for their struggles this season. The car just hasn't worked for them, and the whole team has gone through a process of change. You've had Sam Michael going out, Mark Gillen coming in, Mike Coughlin coming in. So this almost is the last throw of the dice for Williams, because it takes a long time to build a Grand Prix team up from the back to the front. And they've basically gone from the front and they're getting towards the back. So they're almost at the point where they're starting from scratch again. They've got a good facility there, but there's actually as well no reason with Williams why they should be at the front at the moment. Historically, fine. But, you know, they're a medium-sized Grand Prix team, medium-large Grand Prix team. They're doing all right, so they should be sitting fourth, fifth, sixth in the Constructors' Championship. And that's generally where they've been the last few years. This has been a terrible season for them. But the real worry is if they're going to have a driver lineup next year. Pastor Maldonado's had a good year. If they don't have someone like Rubens, who are they going to have in the car to really drive the development? So there's a lot of questions to be answered next year by Williams. And I have a fear that ultimately we are seeing a team that's in terminal decline in terms of being able to ever replicate their tremendous success of the past.
Yeah. Johnny, if you were Frank Williams and the senior management at Williams, would you keep Rubens for development ability and experience?
Yeah, I would. I mean he showed at the end of the season again what he can do when he's motivated and chasing a contract. I think he obviously lost spirit in the middle of the year when things weren't going very well, and you know, his age and his experience, he's not going to put his neck on the line to qualify 14th or 15th. But I'd keep him on board. He's motivated. And I think Pastor needs an experienced guy alongside him. Mm. You know, Pastor may have some, you know, talent and speed and be brilliant around Monaco, but he's not the sort of guy who's going to lead a team and push on direction and fight you to the front of the grid.
Do you think Rubens' name's gone close to the top of the pile now? Kimi's thrown his lot in with Lotus Renault?
Oh, I think it's Sutil v. Rubens. I think it's a straight, and whether the money Sutil has is worth more than Rubens' experience.
Yeah. Okay, just the new teams, as we shouldn't really call them anymore. Andrew, Tony Fernandez rates Lotus's season as 8 out of 10. You're already shaking your head.
Yeah, I don't know where he pulled that figure from. I don't know whether it came out of a Christmas cracker or something.
Is it 0.8 out of 10?
That would be nearer to the mark, I would imagine. I mean, this is a team. I went to the original launch of Lotus Racing, and they were talking then of potentially scoring points in their first season towards the end of the year. The second season, they were going to score regular points and possibly even challenge for a podium. They can't even get out of Q1 on raw pace. I mean, how is that 8 out of 10?
Mm.
I mean, they say if they had Kurs, then they'd be fighting Williams. Well, that just doesn't stack up. I mean, the nearest they've ever got to getting out of a Q1 is half a second. Well, Kurs is worth between 0.3 and 0.6. How does that end up taking 5 points? I mean, and if Maldonado hadn't been viciously assaulted at Monaco by Lewis Hamilton, they'd have had a stack load more points. I just don't see. I mean, 4 or 5 out of 10, maybe. I mean, it's clearly quite a well-run team. But with the Renault engine, with the Red Bull work at the rear of the car, with the personnel they've got on board, a much bigger budget than the other new teams there around there. Merely beating Virgin and HRT is not an 8 out of 10 performance, I'm sorry.
No. Karun, you've raced for Lotus this year, of course, at the Nürburgring. Just give us a few ideas of what it's like immersed in the garage of this team that's not yet achieving.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it's been a tough season. I think there's no doubt about it. I think, you know, as VDB said, you know, I wasn't with the team last year, and I wasn't actually aware of those targets that they'd set till now. But I think the aero development didn't quite go in the way that the team had hoped. You know, the start of the season, I don't think we were too far away. When you look at Shanghai, we were within sort of 5 or 6 tenths, and we thought, okay, if you can keep the development going, you stand half a chance of chasing Williams and at the time Force India. Then we got to Barcelona and everyone chucked the updates on the car, and all of a sudden, as the season went on, that lap delta went up to sort of 1.2 to 1.5 for the rest of the year and stayed there, you know, till pretty much Brazil, really, where the new rear wing seemed to work, and again the gap came down. But as VDB said, I don't think realistically on pace the team was ever there to get into Q2.
I think the one question is what can you realistically expect from startup Grand Prix teams in their first few years? I think Lotus have done okay. The question is where they stop improving. But I think part of the problem is when you talk up your chances and you're talking about being in the midfield and, you know, you're finishing ahead of midfielders, you've had a stop-go penalty or a drive-through penalty in the race and heralding that as great progress, I think maybe you make a little bit of a rod for your own back. I'm sure they'll improve next year, but it's a question of just how far they can go in terms of the budget, the facilities, and whether they can really establish themselves as a midfield team. And they really need to be taking a proper step and be real Q2 contenders on a normal, all things being equal, day next year for it to be a success.
But the other thing to take into account is if you're a team launching, you're not going to come out there and say, we hope to be qualifying 14th this season and that'll be our highlight. You know, you want teams to be ambitious. And Team Lotus has come in. It's finished 10th 2 years out of three. It's got the column one money, which is worth about $30 million. Then move forward. But I think next year is the key season. They have to break into the established teams next year for it to justify its place, really.
Yeah. Another team that needs to really kind of up its game in year three is Hispania Racing. It handed Daniel Ricciardo his debut at Silverstone sort of mid-year. How do you think he got on?
I think Dan did a good job. You know, I think it's always... I mean, I've been in that car, in fact, the very same chassis, I think. and I've been in that position, and I think Ed and I were talking about earlier this year, it's always hard to judge drivers in that situation where, you know, it's you don't know the circumstance. I mean, there were plenty of races last year where I had problems with the car or Bruno had problems with the car, and to the outside world, for you guys, you wouldn't know that. You know, you look at the end result and say, well, he beat his teammate or he didn't, and, you know, try and judge something. But obviously knowing the people within the team very well, and I still get on very well with the engineers, I think they were hugely impressed with Dan to get in it straight away, and he was, you know, he was really close to Liuzzi, you know, and I think given the fact that he never tested the car before Silverstone, I think he out-qualified Liuzzi a few times by the end of the year. I think you know, I really rate Dan. He's a mate of mine, but apart from that, even I think I really rate him as a driver. And
when Ed did his Grand Prix rankings for the British Grand Prix and he gave Dan 8 out of 10, I was slightly miffed, to be honest. But I think actually in the long run, Ed was proved to be right. I think he produced some really, really solid performances that showed that he has got a quite a decent future as a Grand Prix driver. A little bit surprised that maybe he's not going to Toro Rosso, but I think a Caterham seat could be a good one for him if they do make the step forward that they threaten to next year. And maybe there'll be one Aussie replacing another in Red Bull a little bit further down the line.
I think his problem is, though, he's the fifth driver out of the, you know, staircase of Fizz, isn't he? Isn't he going to get stuck in the sort of bottleneck of Red Bull drivers?
Yeah. Right, and finally, for the second year in a row, Virgin finished bottom of the table. They've got good people at that team, like Pat Simmons, who worked with Alonso in the title years at Renault. What's the story at Virgin, Ed?
Well, ultimately, the car, both last year and this year, was rubbish. Not to put too fine a point on it. That's why they took a very extreme decision. They parted company with Nick Wirth. They've created their own technical department that they own, and they're going to operate themselves under Pat Simmons, who's de facto technical director, if you like, but he is still a consultant as per the terms of his status in F1 at the moment.
Yeah.
Ultimately, you've got to say that Nick Wirth couldn't deliver the car that was promised. He was a CFD evangelist, and CFD is a fantastic technology, but his whole business model was based on promoting CFD and CFD alone. You need to use all the tools available to you. You can't say, well, I'll use the spanners, but I'm not going to use the torque wrench or whatever. You've got to use everything that's available to you. And from my understanding of the people on the technical side in terms of the car design who are still there and involved, they're much, much happier with the way things are going now. And unfortunately, Nick couldn't deliver the car that he promised to. He also had a tendency to overpromise and underdeliver in performance, which didn't always delight the race team, it's fair to say.
I mean, I won't be as diplomatic as Ed has been, but I think, you know, CFD, I remember speaking to Patrick Head about this last year at the Goodwood Festival of Speed, and, you know, we were talking about CFD and the wind tunnel and things like that, and he was asking about, you know, the teams, the new teams on the grid last year, and he sort of explained to me about how CFD with a closed wheel car, like an LMP car, which was designed, which was actually, I think, a very good LMP car, the Acura, it works brilliantly. But as soon as you've got open wheel cars and you know the turbulent air coming through the front suspension, the CFD doesn't quite simulate it in the right way, in the way that you know you can get the results out of a wind tunnel. I think that possibly was, you know, from what Patrick was explaining to me, that sounds like maybe that was some of their problem this year.
You've also got the problem with the CFD is as you go downstream in the airflow, there's more and more calculations deciding where the air is going to be. And as soon as you've got rotating wheels creating vortices and open wheelers and all these things, it gets extremely difficult to be completely certain that you're getting an accurate portrayal of how the car's going to behave. It's not that CFD is bad. It's just that currently you can't rely on it. Maybe there'll come a time where you can. And I think every team in F1 is extremely open to CFD. But unfortunately for this team, it just didn't work.
I think, I mean, CFD, every team on the grid, including a Red Bull or McLaren, everybody uses it, but it needs to be used in conjunction with the wind tunnel program to deliver the end result. I think on its own, you know, maybe the technology is not yet ready at the moment.
I think talking about the team as a whole, I think, you know, there was an element of naivety when they came into it. I mean, Boothie runs fantastic race teams, as we've seen all the way through his career. But the task that was in front of them was bigger than they ever imagined it was. And they know now that they're in it for the long haul. Even next year, they know they're not going to be able to rock the world. But they're talking about 2 or 3 years down the line. Just even on next year, he's got a mate who works there, and he says he should see our fuel tank. You know, we've got this amazing fuel tank for next year.
Is it big enough to finish racing?
Exactly. It's at least going to do that. But it is going to give us a performance step. But we know it's not going to be enough because we're just catching that element up. And there's, you know, a finite number of elements they need to add to that car to make it anywhere near the pace. Mm.
I think it's worth noting that the race team side, in terms of race operations, is a pretty tidy operation there. The crux of the problem they've had is that the car that they've been delivered, effectively, in a way, they're a customer to their own technical department in their first 2 years. Obviously, this has changed now, but that's been the nub of the problem. We can't really judge the effectiveness of the race team compared to all the other teams until we see them operating a proper car.
Mm. I think Pick's an interesting choice, although I'm sure that his wallet made that decision ultimately rather than the pace over D'Ambrosio. But in World Series and in GP2, he's been a decent, strong front-running driver there. And, you know, we need a Frenchman on the grid, I think. It's been a while since we had one. And I think he actually could have a bit of potential.
Yeah. Will he do a better job than Jérôme D'Ambrosio?
If you sort of compare them like for like, you have to say he probably is a tenth or two quicker ultimately.
And it's at that level, it's all about the car, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, right, that's our team-by-team wrap. But finally, boys, I'd like you to tell me your highlight of the season. Mine, in case you cared, is sitting in a restaurant in Le Mans, having had 40,000 litres of cheap white wine after an exhausting 24 hours that saw huge shunts and nip-and-tuck Peugeot Audi stuff, watching Jenson Button in that bonkers Canadian Grand Prix. And the telly was in the corner a long way away, and it was rowdy, and we were looking at the screens between gulps going, Michael Schumacher's running second, Jensen's last, what's going on? Vettel's crashing, and that was epic stuff. Johnny?
I think, you know, we're all here to watch fantastic racing. And I think my highlight of the season, also the biggest disappointment, was Monaco this year. It was an absolute barnstormer race. You know, Vettel, Alonso, Button, all on different strategies, all wheel to wheel, temps deciding it, pushing on and on and on, building up to an absolute climax of finish, and then that red flag came out and it was all ruined. So, you know, great race. Love it when you guys are going absolute flat chat, leaving us on the edge of our seats, but I would have loved to have seen that race run to its natural conclusion.
Was it Maldonado who spoiled that, crashing at the swimming pool?
It was Lewis and Alguersuari and Petrov and a whole host of people.
I'll always remember that for finding out that under red flag conditions you can change your rear wing, which I never realised that you could do. I mean, that's... Yeah, when the race is red flag, it's not like part for me. Well, no, I think they've changed the rule now. Anyway, mine isn't actually race-related, although Lewis Hamilton's involved. I was fortunate enough to pay a trip to Watkins Glen when he and Tony Stewart swapped cars for the day. Then lots of people were making jokes beforehand about Stewart's ability to get into an F1 car. But actually, obviously, the cockpit of that McLaren's quite commodious because he slipped in no bother at all. Unfortunately, it was a little bit wet on the day, but Stewart was very impressive, actually, the commitment he was showing around there, because there's not a lot of runoff at Watkins Glen. But the real highlight was seeing Lewis in that NASCAR, because he took to that like a duck to water, as you would in those conditions. And at the end, when he pulled up on the line and he did some donuts and everything for the fans there, and that's Lewis at his best when he's behind the wheel and he's just really enjoying himself. And it was an absolutely fantastic day.
I think mine is also it's commitment related as well. Actually, it's the British Grand Prix this year. I was watching between Aintree and Beckett. It's a great place to watch. You get to see the cars twice a lap, and the DRS zone I think was before the Aintree, and so some of the cars would be going through that as the race dried up, when DRS was available again. Some drivers were using it, some drivers weren't, and Sergio Perez was straight on it straight away, massively sideways every lap. Nico Rosberg, very similarly, he was also absolutely amazing through Beckett's when he was chasing Chewy, and just great to see drivers absolutely on the edge in conditions that were really, really marginal.
Ed?
Well, for me this season, I'll always remember it for Sebastian Vettel's incredible form, and I think it was at Monza. Alonso was leading. Vettel was second. You know, Red Bull were thinking, yeah, you'll be able to get him on the pit stops. You know, wait until that, whenever it will be, sit behind him. But Vettel opted to attack him coming off Curva Grande, went onto the grass at 160 miles an hour more to pull off the move. And you could almost see Alonso in the car thinking, it's worked.
Yeah.
And it just felt to me like Seb was on principle saying, I'd want to win this race. I don't want to pass on pit stops and win it. I want to win, go wheel to wheel and say, yeah, I've overtaken you, I've won that race. And that also answered a few critics who said that he wasn't capable of overtaking.
Yeah, cool. Karun?
Well, I'm going to be cheeky and choose two. I mean, first one was to drive around the circuit in India on Friday morning, having walked around that piece of land when it was an empty piece of dirt, really, and then see how the circuit developed and to finally see Formula One cars going around there. Although by lunchtime, it was as if Santa Claus had taken my present away. But I think as a race, my highlight would be Suzuka. I thought, you know, Jensen's win there, I thought was fantastic. You know, it was, you know, clean, dry race in normal circumstances, unlike in Canada or Budapest. I think it was an outstanding race. I thought these were three drivers at the peak, you know, Vettel, Alonso and Jensen. And I thought that was a really, really good race.
So you didn't choose FP1 in Australia?
I don't remember what happened. There was I have amnesia towards that one.
It was a big wall that jumped out in front of you. It was very embarrassing.
Oh, you're awful, you lot. Well, that was a fitting way to conclude our review of a record-breaking season for Vettel, and one in which Formula One rediscovered overtaking. Join us in the new year when we'll be taking a look at the new 2012 cars and seeing if anyone can stop Red Bull and Vettel. Thanks for listening. Have a great Christmas. And that's a lap.